Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin and talk about the crisis in Korea with somebody that's actually spent a lot of time in North Korea. We'll be speaking in a moment with Peter Hayes, who's the director of the Nautilus Institute, which is a research policy institute in Berkeley, California, that studies nuclear issues and in particular focus on North Asia. And we'll be talking to him about North Korea and the leadership there, the people there, this so-called hermit kingdom, which is sealed to the world. Little is known about it, but we'll get as much as we can learn about this country, hopefully. It'll shed some light on this crisis. And then we'll talk with Philip Coyle, who's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense. He was the head of test evaluation at the Pentagon up until recently. He oversaw the testing of the National Missile Defense, or SDI, the Osprey, the Crusader, and 200 other major weapons systems. We're talking to him about the early deployment of the strategic defense, or national missile defense, in Alaska, announced a couple of weeks ago by President Bush, whether or not these tests that they've been conducting out of the Pacific are rigged, and whether or not this whatever's being built up in Alaska will do anything that it is advertised to do. And we'll also be joined by Ted Postal, who's a senior fellow at MIT's at MIT and head of their national security program. And there was an article in the New York Times this week about how Ted Postal has been suggesting for the longest time that the national missile defense tests are rigged, and has accused MIT of complicity, since an MIT institute that conducted some of these tests was involved in them. And apparently, according to the New York Times, it looks as though Ted Postal is being proven right. So he'll be joining us, as well as Philip Coyle, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. Let's now go to the subject of North Korea. I'm speaking with Peter Hayes, who's the director of the Nautilus Institute, which is a research policy institute that studies nuclear weapons issues, particularly in South Asia. And today in Moscow, the South Korean Deputy Foreign Minister and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister met, and apparently they came out with some sort of optimistic communique suggesting that both the Russians and the South Koreans can affect things. You've traveled to the North quite a lot. Do you think that that there is any way to get that these other players can solve this problem, given that the North Koreans essentially are trying to marginalize the South? They've always done that and wanted to deal directly with the Americans.
Well, I think they will continue to want to deal directly with the Americans. The problem is not, in fact, at this point, the North Koreans, in terms of restarting dialogue. It's the United States, which is assiduously sitting on its hands. And so the question at this point is whether the South can bring sufficient leverage, not so much on Pyongyang, but on the United States, to actually start talks as to what now needs to happen. And without talks, it's simply impossible to resolve the situation, because there's just too much at stake and there are too many important details that, if they were dropped, would later be the cause of endless confrontation and contention. So it actually is necessary that the talks begin, whether they're called fireside chats, conversations, dialogues. It seems anything short of negotiation is possible, and that just isn't going to hack it, I'm afraid.
So some of the President Bush's critics are suggesting that the situation is analogous to what happened in the Middle East, where as long as there was a hands-on policy on the part of Clinton, right up until the end, as it happened with the Israelis and the Palestinians, and hands-on policy vis-a-vis North Korea, things were contained. And when the Bush administration came in, they made it clear that they didn't want to get mired in the Middle East, and they backed away from North Korea. So is it a question of having a hands-on policy? Because obviously the North Koreans suckered the U.S., and they made an agreement on plutonium, but then secretly explored the uranium route to a bomb.
Well, I think they currently have what you could
No.
That's fine. My kids are playing the piano. So to really answer your question, I think you have to look for the analogy not so much in the Middle East, but actually in Korea. And the appropriate analogy is the last time we were in a crisis cycle, which was in 1994, when, again, they were doing things at their reactors without the IAEA present. And we were shifting towards war. The U.S. is talking at the Security Council about sanctions. And that was when the North Koreans made the famous statement about making Seoul into a sea of fire. And we really did have a free fall towards war, because we later found out in the inner sanctums of U.S. national security policy making and decision making, they were setting up a military strike and were expecting that there could be a full-scale war after that. And this was only averted by Jimmy Carter going north. And that was not with full White House support, to put it mildly. And he was the one who really initiated the negotiation process that led to the freeze and the agreed framework. So I think that the correct questions to be asking at the moment are, what steps did the North Koreans take in the period between May and September of 94 that led to the resumption of dialogue and then eventually an agreement? And I think those steps were pretty clear. They were the unilateral freeze of their activities, and I think this is the concession from the North that the South Koreans will be seeking, and there'll be some interim measures of monitoring and verification, not of course full-scope safeguards at this point. That will only come after a full-scale dialogue with the U.S. And then there would need to be a high-level emissary from the United States to North Korea, really the equivalent of a Jimmy Carter. Well, who's the Jimmy Carter of this administration? It might be Bush Sr., I'm really not sure, but someone of that level and status has to go to North Korea and become the emissary. And that's what's really needed. Can you stay on 1 second?
Sure. Let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Peter Hayes, who is the director of the Nautilus Institute, which is a research policy institute in Berkeley, California, that studies and investigates nuclear issues, particularly in South Asia. And Peter has been to North Korea on a number of occasions, and we're talking about, obviously, efforts to defuse the crisis between the United States and North Korea, as the South Korean Deputy Foreign Minister and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister.
Sorry, I'm keeping a quiet spot in the house. I'm back.
Good. Let me go back to the 94 defusing of the crisis by Jimmy Carter's intervention, where he met with the so-called great leader, the father of the current leader.
That's right.
Kim Il-sung, and Jimmy Carter more or less forced the Clinton administration's hand by having CNN ready to go. And he sort of, in effect, blackmailed him. But, of course, he was dealing with the father. There's always been this impression that the son has taken some time to gain all the levers of power. You've been into North Korea, so you perhaps have a better idea than most people. Is the dear leader, the son of Kim Il-sung, in charge? Because apparently it's taken him a while to get the generals on side, and I've seen pictures of the generals on television, and my God, they've got so many medals they can barely stand up. So,
well, I mean, first of all, you know, these two presidents are both the sons of former presidents, and these are both dynastic successions in some sense, although from very different political cultures and roots. But there is a certain similarity there. But really, the key issue is how to understand Kim Jong-il, and certainly he's not a charismatic leader like his father, Kim Il-sung, reportedly was. I've never met either of these gentlemen, but by all reports, Kim Jong-il really had most of the operational levers of policymaking and power in his hand, in fact, by the early 1980s, 20 years ago. And, of course, it was only after his father's death in July of 94 that the full mantle was put on his shoulders of leadership, but he's had now nearly, 9 years to complete his succession, and I don't think anyone has any doubts that he is now the great leader. In fact, he is now formally called He's dead, but he's still the president, according to a constitutional revision they made some years ago. But there's no doubt that Kim Jong-il is in command. Now, what kinds of intra-elite consensus formation discussions have to go on within the Kim clique and between the generals and Kim Jong-il, no one really knows. Such a process does exist. He doesn't just rule by edict, but it is an extraordinarily centralized and personalized and political regime, and that's really the essence of the problem. That's the political culture. And in the United States, power, by contrast, is decentralized, and it's legal and bureaucratic and impersonal, and it's really about as different to North Korea as a political culture as you can imagine. So getting any communication that's sustained and any real understanding between these two leaders is well nigh impossible, which is why it's been so difficult.
Peter Hayes, it seems though that, of course, by creating this crisis, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has exposed the hypocrisy, if you will, of the U.S. Concentration on Iraq, because clearly the fears that one day Saddam Hussein may get a nuclear weapon and therefore exercise nuclear blackmail pale before the reality that the North Koreans are exercising nuclear blackmail. And the CIA estimates they have two bombs. With these 8,000 fuel rods, they could make about six in if they did a crash program, perhaps 9 months to a year from now. So it's clearly working in terms of nuclear blackmail. But the fundamental difference seems to be that in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, who's kept in power by the Mukhabarat and by the basically preemptively murdering and torturing any potential opponent, there's no support within the country for him, apparently. And the pressure that they're putting on now with deploying all these troops will probably result in him in a kind of Romanian scenario where he'll be taken out before the coalition have to go in. At least that seems to be the way it's shaping up.
Well,
conversely, in North Korea, there doesn't seem to be this disconnect, even though you would think that the North Korean people, who are apparently starving, would be, shall we say, unhappy with their leadership. There doesn't seem to be any indication that the clique of leaders don't have anything but absolute control.
Well, I think that's actually correct, although it's not absolute control in, how can I put it, in a purely bureaucratic sense. I mean, you have to, the tremendous differences between Iraq, I'm not an Iraq specialist by any means, but the tremendous differences between Iraq and North Korea, which explain the difference in the approaches taken by the Bush administration. And one of them is that North Korea has been, Korea has been a single unified administrative control apparatus as a proto-state and then as a nation-state for nearly, depending how you measure it, 3,000 to 5,000 years continuously. They know how to do vertical control, and it's a very homogenous culture, unlike Iraq, which is constituted of various and quite antagonistic ethnicities, which Saddam Hussein has ruled with an iron hand or fist. Whereas in the DPRK, Kim Jong-il doesn't have to do that. He has a different kind of legitimacy. And in fact, that is one of the strengths of the regime, particularly in rural areas, which are more orthodox than in the city. That's where you find the strength of the regime actually resides. But the essential difference between Iraq and North Korea from the Bush administration's perspective and from the viewpoint of actually resolving this without a major war or without a nuclear proliferation, you know, an actual declared nuclear capacity by the North, is to recognize the difference between Saddam Hussein's strategic objectives and those of Kim Jong-il. I mean, the North Koreans have been saying now since 1978, but most loudly since 1994, and vociferously in the late 90s, and then continuously through today, that their strategic objective is to engage and essentially neutralize the United States as an adversary. They, at the very least, would have the United States not as an enemy, not in its space in the international financial institutions, and excluding it is very different to Saddam Hussein. There's no possibility in my mind that Saddam Hussein and George Bush could get together and find common ground at the level of their strategic objectives. They're now intractably and irreversibly antagonistic. And so that's really the big difference.
And you're also saying that we hold all the cards.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the United States really does hold all the cards, because if they do go down this path of nuclear weapons proliferation, I mean, there's nothing that could make the Pentagon and the nuclear weapons establishment more comfortable than the prospect of containing another nuclear weapons state. I mean, they know how to do that. They've spent 5 decades honing that sword. Cooperative engagement, it's low cost, that's hard. huge military forces armed with nuclear weapons, that's something we know how to do. So, bring it on. That's not something that really frightens Washington. It would create certain political difficulties, but no more than the current situation is creating. So I don't see that this is completely impossible to resolve at all. It's a question of the political will and the vision in the White House as to whether they can unify their own policy, which is currently, I have to say, in disarray, and get into the business of holding their nose and engaging Kim Il-sung, and actually achieving the things that the United States above all wants, and recognizing that this regime is going to endure, odious as it might seem to Americans.
But it seems, though, I mean, to be very cynical, the only way that this administration has been able to sell Star Wars, which most analysts, including there's a specialist out here, used to be head of test evaluation at the Pentagon that I know, who very, very knowledgeable. Basically, the thing is way off, and it seems like a massive boondoggle, but they've actually accelerated deployment and of something that may or may not work in Alaska, but it's all aimed at North Korea. And it seems to me that the North Koreans actually are the best salespeople for the military-industrial complex over here in terms of a new, vast boondoggle.
Well, I think that's true at a surface level, but really, in the long run, national missile defense is not aimed at North Korea, and everyone knows this, it's aimed at China. And in the kind of timelines for this kind of technology to actually start to work in a political and military sense, everyone expects North Korea to go away one way or another, including the Chinese. So everyone knows that NMD, in the 10 to 15 year time frame that it will take to actually develop the technology and deploy it, is really not about North Korea. And if the North Koreans were to disappear tomorrow, which after all is conceivable, they could implode, although it's highly improbable, then the United States would go right ahead with national missile defense. So, the fact is that the North Koreans still have their whole missile export program and their whole missile research and domestic deployment program on the table, ready to be bought out. This was put on the table at the end of the Clinton administration, and it remains on the table. They stated at that time, this is right at the end of the Clinton administration, that they would cease exporting all missiles of all ranges, and they would neither make nor deploy any more missiles of any range domestically, nor export any. Now, this got hung up on monitoring and verification provisions, but with time that could have been solved. Instead, what happened is the Bush administration came in and terminated discussion. But ironically, this offer is still on the table for taking. It's low, hanging ripe fruit for Bush to pluck. And, what is better for Bush, to have threatened the use of military force in the public explanation of policy, and then gained North Korean capitulation at almost no cost to the United States, because the economic heavy lifting would be done by South Korea and Japan in kickstarting the North Korean economy, or having to actually respond militarily and or with the deployment of nuclear weapons, which would upset the allies and friends in the region. I mean, he needs a foreign policy victory, particularly one as easy as this, so he can go off and crush Iraq. I mean, this is complicating the Iraq situation at the moment, and he wants it, quiescent, if not resolved. So, from his perspective, military in North Korea, in my view, are highly unlikely to be terribly favorable towards a nuclear weapon. It diverts resources. It diverts attention from the role of the conventional military. To some extent, it substitutes for them. And it's usually developed by a non-military institution, and that is the case in North Korea. They are responsible for the delivery system, but not for the warhead. And so Kim Jong-il really can have a small pile of nuclear weapons and sit on them, have no economy, and have a very unhappy military. Or he can trade in his nuclear weapons, have an economy, and have a modernizing military with smiles on their faces. I mean, if you're Kim Jong-il, which are you going to like? Which are you going to prefer? So there is the basis here if the two sides can overcome these currently very rigid positions, and I'm confident they can.
Well, I think, though, Peter, that still in my cynicism, skepticism still holds because, in effect, you know, the reason we're going after Iraq is that we can. He's just a small-time punk. This guy in North Korea is a little more difficult, a little more serious, but as you've pointed out, we hold all the cards.
That's right.
So I can't help feeling that what the Bush people are doing is they're essentially keeping a problem out there alive to justify the kind of paranoid foreign policy. I mean, if these problems can be much more easily solved, why is this a way to make the American people feel like they're under a threat and that they have to support a vast military machine? I mean, I know that sounds conspiratorial, but
well, I mean, I guess the thing that one discovers when one goes and talks to the people who have their hands on the levers of policy in Washington, in the National Security Council, in the White House, at the State Department, the military, the intelligence community, and then U.S. Forces Korea, and all the sort of intermediate institutions, the think tanks, the media, you know, one might think that there is an overarching kind of strategic game plan or logic at play, but there isn't. There are just conflicting policy currents that collide at fairly low levels in the bureaucracy, and basically there's stasis as a result. There are lots of whirlpools and gyres and eddies which result in short-term decision-making of the kind that led to this crisis, incidentally, when they cut off the heavy fuel oil without thinking it through last November. But there is, in fact, no game plan. There's no strategic logic here, and that's precisely the problem. I mean, Bush has to unify his administration's position. He has to bring in a Bill Perry equivalent to this administration to unify the position of Congress and the executive branch.
And to mention state and DOD. And
well, I mean, putting it bluntly, you have an axis of evil and an axis of good in terms of you know, preference for unilateral military force versus multilateral diplomacy backed up by all the other instruments of policy. And those axes transect all these different bureaucracies, and they're based on political appointees and networks of ideology and influence.
Right, and the impression is that the political operative in the White House, Karl Rove, who has no international or foreign policy experience, is in fact a more dominant influence than most. At least that's what the critics are saying.
Well, I don't know about his role in relation to Korea policy. I've seen the media speculations about his role in Iraq, but I don't know, you know, whether he's more or less influential. But I guess my point is that unless Bush now uses, I guess, his enhanced legitimacy from the vote in the last election to start to actually overrule some of the bureaucrats and start to impose a unified policy position, and then explains the roadmap that's produced to the North Koreans so they know what they have to do precisely. I mean, if they were to take American policy seriously right now, they would take their nuclear weapons capacities, whatever they are, plutonium and uranium, and they'd put them on a boat and they'd take them out to the Mid-Pacific deep ocean trench, and they'd dump them. And as a result, we'd have an undocumented Iraqi-style cessation and dismantlement of their program. And that would lead to endless confrontation and contention. We actually don't want them to do what they're being asked to do at the moment. In a technical sense, that would be disastrous. So they actually need a detailed roadmap. You know, you do this, we'll do that. Then we'll do this, and then you'll do that. That's what's actually needed.
Well, just in closing then, Peter, because I, I, I wanted, obviously, to talk to you because you've been to North Korea, as very few people have, and I think on a number of occasions. So, although it's very opaque and difficult, and you nevertheless have some idea about what makes that society tick and allows this dynasty that live in, you know, with this extraordinary cult of personality and vast palaces while apparently the people are starving. There's, I don't know how much starvation's going on. I guess nobody really does know. Curiously, the CIA statistics on around the world, on the demographics, etc., suggest that the longevity in North Korea is not much different from the South. So that's a strange disconnect. But just in closing, just give us a sense of how you could have a society that's based upon this Juche philosophy, which is translated, I believe, as self-reliance. How could you sustain the illusion of self-reliance when you're an international basket case rattling a tin cup?
Well, it's very difficult, and the only real answer to that, because this is a country in which ideology still rules, as embodied by the Juche Tower at night in Pyongyang, burning up what power, little power there is in the country, to the glory of the party and the leadership. And then in human rights, you see corvée, slave labor of thousands of mobilized 8 and 9 year olds in the rain breaking rocks to build a highway for the few party vehicles that speed past 60 miles an hour. And then you go to the factories, and what you see are people tearing apart obsolete plants, steel plants, with their bare hands. That's the state of industry. So it really is a disastrous case. You know, you overlay that with floods and famine because of really bad land use decisions in the 1980s and people starving. It is a basket case. But on the other hand, you have an extraordinarily unified and organized population, which is culturally homogenous, speaks the same language, has a common history, and is actually highly knowledgeable. And this is perhaps the key to your question: how can you have such a stable disaster? And I think one of the reasons is that North Koreans actually have a very distorted view of history, as do all Koreans, I have to say, which is that they are always the victims of outsiders, of great powers. And there is a historical truth to that, but this is a very common nationalist theme in both Koreas. And they actually do know their relative state in the world. So you find that average Koreans out in the provinces, factory leaders, farm chiefs, all the way down to the locals, actually are relatively well-informed. And that comes partly because the very control mechanisms by which any alignments of opposition in the capital city in Pyongyang to the Kim clique are controlled is by sending people out as satellites. Either you get sent out to the provinces, you get sent out to an embassy overseas, you get sent out to another agency. You're constantly circulating people. And that means, of course, that people are carrying their information from overseas or from Pyongyang into and then around the country at high speed. The tighter the control, the faster the circulation. And so people are actually pretty well informed. And that means that about probably 60% of the people you would see are just apathetic and busy, trying to survive. About 10 to 20% of true believers, ideological molded products who would die tomorrow and push a bayonet in your stomach without thinking. And the rest are highly cosmopolitan, sophisticated players who play, you know, Chopin and listen to international radio. And they're really the people who understand the patriotic duty of North Koreans to come to terms with the South without a war and slowly bring about a reunification of the Korean Peninsula. And stand up to the rest of the world and claim their rightful place. And that's, of course, really what this is all about, ultimately, is the competition for legitimacy and the claim to the Korean soul. And that's why this will take a long, long time to be sorted out. And that's why, in fact, Americans eventually will have to stand back and let the Koreans bring it to a resolution themselves.
And even though it seems that the South wins hands down, the North still got some leverage, you're suggesting, I guess.
Well, they have a lot of leverage, both political and military, and that's what's playing itself out now with the newly elected left-wing administration there, which is not by any means pro-North or anti-American. That's just a beat up in the press. This is a very suspicious
But if war is inadmissible, at some point or other, the North's going to have to come to terms with.
Well, I think it is coming to terms with the South. I mean, they're opening a large area north of the DMZ for hundreds, if not thousands, of South Korean firms and their partners, incidentally, to build plants to exploit the North Korean labor. They are, of course, trying to build two light water reactors in cooperation with South Korea. I mean, there's a lot going on below the surface between the two Koreas. And that's what actually gives South Korea some leverage against the United States at this point, because that's real leverage with Pyongyang as against mere threat-based leverage, which is not terribly substantial when you're facing an adversary that has China as its ally. So, you know, there are very real limits on American power vis-a-vis North Korea, and they've always skillfully, very skillfully, exploited competition for their attention between Beijing and Moscow to boot. So now you have everyone competing for Pyongyang's attention. What a wonderful position for Kim Jong-il to be in.
Right. I mean, for a guy that can't feed his own people, and sitting on a basket case, it makes you wonder who's in charge in this world. You know, lunatics and thugs get everybody's attention.
Yep, I don't think he's a lunatic. I don't know if he's a thug, but I can tell.
Well, I'm referring to other people like Saddam Hussein, who gets equal amounts of attention too.
Oh, I see. Right.
I mean, in other words, it seems to be that's if you're a bad boy, it's a squeaky wheel that gets the grease, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the biggest picture, this is ultimately about U.S.-Chinese competition, and the irony here is the first 2 years of Bush. Bush's policy has actually ceded leadership to China, which was embodied in the trip last week of South Koreans to Beijing first rather than Washington first to solve this problem. And it would take some very rapid catch-up for the United States to recover its position in the peninsula. And I think the United States is capable of doing that. It's done it before, but it remains to be seen whether Bush has the skills to pull that off. And so, meanwhile, everything hangs in the balance.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Peter Hayes.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Peter Hayes, who is the director of the Nautilus Institute, which is a research policy institute that studies nuclear issues, particularly in relation to North Asia. I'm joined in the studio by Philip Coyle, who's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, where he was also head of test evaluation at the Pentagon, and he oversaw 200 major systems, including National Missile Defense, or SDI, the Osprey, the Crusader, etc., and also Ted Postal, who is a senior fellow at MIT's National Security Program. And beginning with you, Phil Coyle, you were in the Pentagon in 94, when there was apparently fairly advanced plans to attack North Korea, or at least to attack the Yongbyon processing plants. And subsequently, and I guess you worked with Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense, who went to North Korea and brokered the deals to stop the proliferation of missiles. So give us a sense of how much the hands-on in those days was helpful compared to the hands-off of this current administration that has allowed this crisis to bubble and boil over.
Yeah, it's really quite striking when you think back that it was just a few years ago that then former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, he was not in office at that point, serving as an ambassador, went to North Korea and convinced them to give up their missile program. I think Secretary Perry himself would not say that North Korea was therefore no longer a threat of any kind, but they were certainly no longer the same threat they had been before he made those diplomatic trips. So in just a couple of short years, we've gone from that situation where North Korea was agreeing to cooperate to a situation where they're not only daring us to do something about their nuclear programs, but now we've got South Korea mad at us also. So it's a very sad turn of events. Secretary Perry was very effective. He showed that dollar for dollar, all by himself, just one person, he was the most effective missile defense program we ever had.
And Ted Postol, you have been a long critic of SDI and now National Missile Defense. You pointed out after the Gulf War that the Patriots, that were highly touted as being the great weapon of the 91 Gulf War, were in fact missed all their targets, and eventually you were proven right, and the Israelis also weighed in on and agreed with you. And you've been a critic of the tests that have been conducted for this new round of and of course we know now that 2 weeks ago President Bush is even accelerating the deployment of some kind of some kind of Patriot type system in Alaska. But just in this week's New York Times, there was a long article about you and your problems. And with the Pentagon and with MIT, who did a lot of the work on these tests, which you said were rigged, and it looks as though they're starting to investigate your claim seriously.
Well, I don't believe MIT has yet committed to investigating the claim seriously. What they did is they produced basically three internal reports. The second of those reports claimed that there were no problems at all with a critical experiment that was designed to determine whether or not decoys could be selected from warheads so that they could pick the right target. And MIT was involved in misleading federal investigators who were investigating evidence that they had collected that one of the defense contractors, TRW in this case, had fraudulently manipulated data. It now turns out that the data didn't exist. So they manipulated data that basically was useless to make it appear like they could select the warhead from decoys. And MIT was a party to this. And the MIT Corporation has known about this for roughly 20 months. We're getting on to 2 years, and I might add that the chairman of the corporation, the president of the corporation, and the provost have all been repeatedly told about this in letters by me, and finally when I received a letter that indicated they were again, it appeared that they were again trying to evade their responsibility to investigate this, I went to the Congress and very straightforwardly wrote a letter that very straightforwardly pointed out that it appears like there is a cover-up going on at MIT.
And one of the sources for the information about rigging the tests, and in fact, it's even you've taken it even further that the data doesn't even exist. Is what was her name? Neera Schwartz. She was the whistleblower.
Neera Schwartz, right?
Right. And you've been working with her too, I take it.
Yes, and MIT invented the technique that was being used by TRW for picking the let me back up, for matching the signals that they expect to see with the signals that they actually see. So they have to to call this discrimination is a little misleading. It's very misleading. In fact, what
now you're talking about the warhead, right? The intelligent, the brain at the tip of the missile that's the rock that hits the rock.
Right, the kill vehicle, as
the
it's
kill
called,
vehicle. Okay,
which is a telescope, which guides itself into a position so it will impact the threatening object that is the warhead. But the kill vehicle cannot tell the difference between warheads and decoys. And there were only two experiments done to determine how well they could tell the difference between decoys and warheads.
Right, and it's important. And I just want to add that the decoy issue is important because it's easy to have decoys in the vacuum of space that you can.
Right, in the vacuum of space, a balloon of the kind that you can buy at the zoo for your child can be a credible decoy. The objects are seen at very large range, many hundreds of kilometers. For example, if I'm 300 kilometers away when if the kill vehicle is 300 kilometers away, I might only have 10 to 15 seconds to, well, 20 to 30 seconds, I should say, to actually intercept a target of interest. So, for example, if I'm 20 seconds prior to intercepting the target, I could be 200 or 300 kilometers away. So everything I see through this telescope is just a twink, you know, it's a ball of light. It's a point of light.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the characteristics of the signal, which turn out to be basically the how bright the signal is, and whether the signal scintillates or not, and how it scintillates, they try to pick one target from the other. So they have to have an absolutely detailed model of what each of these scintillating points of light should look like from prior calculations. And of course, all they're doing is matching to see if they can, if their prior calculations are accurate enough to pick out the object. It's essentially like optical character reading. It's not truly picking out the object because it has some physical characteristic that's unique to it. It's looking at letters on a page, and anybody who puts a line to one of the letters, the optical character reader will fail.
But rather than get into the technical stuff, which is interesting, but let me just and we've got Phil Coyle here, who's a former head of test evaluation, who knows the SDI and National Missile Defense intimately, and which is saying that the taxpayer got their best value under Bill Perry before all this money flooded in with the new Bush administration, and they're already deploying stuff, and you're indicating that it doesn't work. But let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Phil Cole. Why I understand that this whole idea of shooting down a missile, there are three stages of the incoming one, the one that's attacking you.
Right.
There's the boost phase as it goes up into the atmosphere, where the missile is the most vulnerable. There's the intermediate phase where it comes across the Pacific if it's being launched from China or North Korea. And then there's the terminal or phase or the point defense phase, which is if you know where it's coming, then you've got at least some chance. But all of the efforts that we're talking about and all of the testing that's going on here out of Vandenberg is all for the intermediary phase, which seems to be where it's the easiest to fool the interceptors.
That's true that most of the testing so far has been connected with the mid-course, so-called ground-based mid-course system, which in fact was pushed by the Clinton administration. There's a continuing and growing work for boost phase systems, especially interceptors fired from U.S. Navy ships. That program is growing. It's not as big yet as the ground-based mid-course program that tries to shoot down enemy missiles in the mid-course of their flight, but that's beginning. Ultimately, the Bush administration intends to be able to shoot down missiles of all ranges, short, medium, and long, in all phases of their flight, in the boost phase, when they're ascending, as you say, in the mid-course, and when they're coming back down in the terminal phase. And they intend to do that ultimately from the ground, platforms on the ground, from platforms at sea, on aircraft, and from space. And it's the effort to try to do all of those things in all those different ways that will make this a very big program.
And with all these extra layers, I mean, is anything going to work? I mean, if you're going to have ships off North Korea, I mean, again, you're just talking about how Bill Perry was able to. But they put everything on the table. They're prepared to sell everything just to, you know, to get out of the business. And for some reason or other, we're not taking them up in their offer. But it seems sort of counterintuitive that if you can buy this stuff for a fraction of what you're going to spend on, to have ships 24 hours a day, 365 days a week, sitting off the coast of North Korea and waiting for a missile to go up.
Well, that's one of the reasons why the so-called Nunn-Lugar program, which so far has been a U.S.-Russia cooperative program, is so important, because that program seeks to buy these materials that could be used in nuclear weapons so that they aren't used in weapons.
And Ted Postel, what is it that they're doing in Alaska then? If all of this stuff is so much less than advertised. What are they? What are they digging in the ground up there?
Well, I think it's a political hoax, as far as I can see, and a scientific hoax to try to make it look like the administration is delivering on its promise to deploy a missile defense. It just happens to be something that won't work and will cost tens of billions of dollars, at least on the first phases. But I regard this as quite a cynical hoax on the part of the president and his immediate advisors. If they don't know that this thing doesn't work, it has the problems that people like me and Phil have pointed out, they don't want to know. So, for example, I'm a colleague. In fact, I'm about to take a sabbatical at Stanford. And Condi Rice was a colleague of mine. I often went to lunch with her when I was last here. She knows my expertise. I offered to brief her off the record, and she refused. So it's a pretty disturbing thing when a national security advisor, whose job should be to provide the best advice on matters of national security to the president, chooses to be ignorant. And so I'm unfortunate. I know this is a harsh statement to make, but unfortunately, sometimes the truth is harsh. And I think that this is purely political, so that the administration can claim that it's done something that it really has no chance of doing.
And Phil Coyle, since you were the Assistant Secretary of Defense and head of test evaluating the Pentagon, you must have some experience with the ratio of money to success. I mean, can you simply pour money at a problem and hope for the best? I mean, which is, I guess, if following on what Ted has just said, that seems to be what we're doing. If you take the benign view that it's not a hoax, it's a wish.
Yeah, I think Secretary Rumsfeld and his people are sincere about missile defense, but the technology is very difficult. Missile defense is the most difficult thing the Pentagon has ever tried to do, more difficult than the most modern jet fighters or armored tanks or Navy ships. Missile defense is very difficult, and especially to do it in all of the different ways that I was describing before. That's going to be a very difficult program. It's not unusual for a major defense acquisition program like the F-22 fighter or the Joint Strike Fighter, it's not unusual for them to take 20 years. So we shouldn't be surprised if the efforts on missile defense don't go on for decades.
But it seems to be that if with all that money and 20 years down the road, the only rogue state out there that's got the ability to And they're apparently not sophisticated in missiles, but they've got some kind of intermediate-range missiles, the North Koreans. We can buy them, so I'm trying to think about, get a sense of the cost. Ted, what do you want to say? Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I think there's another way to describe the situation that Phil answered with regard to your question. The way I would explain it is that there is science and technology. Science has to do with basic physical laws that, you have to, as far as we know, the universe follows. And what technology does is it tries to exploit the use of those physical laws to do certain tasks. Now, in the case of, when I say the missile defense has no chance of telling warheads from decoys, I'm referring to the science, not the technology. Now, let me give you an example of why I'm saying this, that I think is reasonably clear and accurate. The kill vehicle is a telescope that looks at objects at great range. So it's basically an optical device. So think, for conceptual reasons, imagine that I'm in an airport and somebody tells me I should find out which suitcase that's laid in front of me has a bomb in it, but I can't use dogs to sniff it, I can't open it up, I can't use x-ray machines. but I can do anything optical that I choose. I can use a microscope, I can use binoculars, I can use my naked eye, I could use rose-colored glasses, whatever. Well, when I look at those suitcases, all I see are the surface of the suitcase. There is no way I can ever know what is inside that suitcase using optics alone. Now, if I have an X-ray machine, I might have a better chance, but the current program has no plans for an X-ray machine, which, in effect, is a nuclear weapon exploding in space, or any other technology. It's based all on optics and radar, both of which have this same problem. They see only the surface of the object, and they have no way of determining what's inside the surface. And the surface is very easy to change and alter. So all you can do is say, well, it's the yellow suitcase. But if I spray green paint on the yellow suitcase, if I don't have that prior knowledge, then I don't know what to match, like this optical character reading I was talking about earlier. So I think it's very fundamental. There is no way this system can ever work.
And what would you then suggest that that the U.S. do instead of all of this, you know, having to spend money on all three phases, the boost, mid-course, and the point defense? I mean, the Israelis just tested their arrows today. Apparently, it's similar to the latest Patriot. And again, these tests are all done in under the best conditions, and because where you know the thing's coming from, you know when and how and where, and you're ready for it, as opposed to something coming out of the blue. I can understand why the Pentagon wanted to protect its forces with point defense. I mean, that seems reasonable. So what do you think is reasonable?
Well, first of all, if we're not talking about a nuclear attack, nuclear attack is, of course, very different. But if we're talking about chemical or biological weapons or high-explosive weapons, if you're talking about forces in the field, these forces are well-equipped to protect themselves. They have suits for that purpose. They would know, unlike many other kinds of chemical attacks or biological attacks, for example, from a drone that's slow-flying that might go undetected, a ballistic missile launched in their direction, they would know about for many minutes, which is enough time to begin to take shelter. Not saying this is good, but shelter makes a big difference. We know from Israel that the warnings that were issued by the Israelis after the Americans alerted them to missile launches basically resulted in maybe one casualty rather than many dozens of casualties is what you would expect. Simply because people had enough time to take shelter. So it's not very satisfying, but it does work. And so this is one of the reasons why you see the Israelis very wisely working on their civil defense for their population. But for military forces, this is a natural, you know, this is part of their training. So you just need to give them early warning. Mm-hmm. And these warheads are destructive if they land on top of you, but if they land even 30 feet from you and you're dug in, there's a good chance you'll survive and not even be injured.
Well, that's an awfully cheap project. You don't have to spend any money. Let me have Phil Coyle answer the same question, because we're running out of time.
Yeah, it was about a dozen years ago that 28 U.S. soldiers were killed in a Scud attack in Saudi Arabia and about 100 wounded. So this is something that American families certainly can understand when their sons and daughters are overseas and could be killed by something like a Scud. The missile programs that are under development, the U.S. Third-generation Patriot and the Israeli Arrow system, have not been tested against Scuds yet. They need to do that to see if they can deal with Scuds.
Well, just a last word from you then, Ted, in terms of your efforts to stop the rigging of these tests and to alert the taxpayer to how their money's being spent.
Yes.
Just a minute.
Well, let me just build on a point that Phil just made, which I agree with, but point out something related to my earlier remarks. We went through the medical literature after the event at Dahrain where these people were killed and injured. And we discovered from the medical literature, which was Army medical literature, that everybody was in beds and sitting openly exposed throughout the attack. Nobody was told to take shelter, probably because they thought they were being defended. If people had just gotten out of their beds and laid down on the floor, there would have been far fewer people killed and injured in that Scud attack. So here is an example where the false belief that you are being defended led to far higher casualties and deaths than would have otherwise occurred.
Well, I thank you both for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time here, gentlemen.
Yes.
But and we should do this when we've got more time to, because we've barely scratched the surface. I thank you for
joining us,
Ted Postal, senior fellow at MIT's National Security Program, and in the studio, Phil Coyle, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, who was head of test evaluation at the Pentagon. And we're getting close to having a website, so we'll be able to rebroadcast it at any time and stream all of the archives as well. So we'll be in touch. You can reach me at ianmasters@mail.com. Bye.